Morning, everybody. Welcome. Everybody's here. We have a new member from the ASBJ board, Ryoko Yanou, who sits here on behalf of the AOSSG.
Today and tomorrow.
And we have two new board members of the ISB, Rika Suzuki from, as her name indicates, from Japan, and Tadeu Sendon from Brazil. They just started on the 1st of July, so this is obviously their first ASEF meeting. China will not be attending this time, but we look forward to seeing them back the next time. I suggest we start our meeting with the discussion of business combinations under common control, and I give the floor to Julia.
Simona.
Okay.
Good morning, as of members. I am now turning to agenda paper 1A. So far, our discussion with ASAF focused on information needs of various types of primary users and on when alternative management approaches should apply. The approaches being developed are a current value approach based on the acquisition method is 9-3 and a former predecessor approach. Slides 10 and 11 provide a recap of our previous discussions with ASAP and board's other consultative bodies. At this meeting, we seek your views on our updated analysis of when alternative management approaches should apply, and we would also like to start a discussion of how those approaches should apply. I'm going to skip slide 4 to 15 that provide a recap of the project, and I will walk you through our updated analysis of when each alternative approach should apply. Starting with transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders on slide 16, on balance, we continue to think that making the distinction based on whether the receiving entity's equity instruments are publicly traded is a viable approach to explore. However, such a distinction may not be enough, as it would not result in current value information provided to any private non-controlling shareholders. At previous meetings, some ASAF members expressed the view that a current value approach should not be restricted to when the receiving entity's equity instruments are traded in a public market. To capture private non-controlling shareholders, the staff considered an exemption from providing current value information similar to the existing exemption from providing consolidated financial statements in IFRS 10, as also suggested by some ASAF members at previous meetings. The staff suggested scope of such an exemption is set out on slide 16. As shown on that slide, the exemption is designed for transactions that affect private non-controlling shareholders and would not apply for non-controlling shareholders of private entities that are also related parties of the receiving entity and related parties of its controlling parties. Slide 17 presents variation of this exemption referred to opt-in and opt-out. Please note that while this variation uses a different starting point conceptually, that is, they start from a predecessor approach or a current value approach, respectively, their practical outcome is the same. Both approaches would effectively result in the application of the current value approach to transactions that affect private non-controlling shareholders when those shareholders wish to receive such information. Moving on to transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders, as illustrated on slide 18 and in agenda paper 1B, the staff think that transactions within the scope of the project that do not result in non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity acquiring a residual interest equity claim in transfer entities or businesses are arguably different from both transactions that result in non-controlling shareholders acquiring such residual interest and business combination not under common control. As a result, the staff think that the predecessor approach would provide useful information about transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders. With that, I'd like to turn to questions on when alternative approaches should apply on slide 20. Question number one relates to transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders. In your view, should the current value approach be required only when receiving entities' equity instruments are traded in a public market, or should it be extended to privately held receiving entities? Please refer to slide 16. If the latter, do you support the opt-in or opt-out approach or a different approach for privately held entities? Question number two relates to transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders. Do you agree with the staff's observations in Agenda Paper 1B that transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity are different from those that do, and if not, why? And with that, we open the floor for a discussion.
Before answering the individual questions, let me confirm our general perspective on BCUC's accounting, which we expressed consistently before. We are not quite convinced with the ISB's current value approach, which focuses on a specific type of information users, such as non-controlling shareholders, when determining accounting method for BCUC. According to the conceptual framework, the objective of general purpose financial statement reporting is to provide useful information about the reporting entity to investors, lenders, and creditors, regardless of their specific mix and regardless of whether they are existing stakeholders or potential stakeholders. However, contrary to this spirit of conceptual framework, the current value approach proposed by the ISB seems to focus on only a specific type of users at the very moment when the BCUCC take place. So I think this implies that general purpose financial reporting could change when the mix of primary users change. So I don't think this is quite right. But having said that, as we are asked about question one and two, based on the current value approach, let me offer our views on those questions on the assumption that we agree with the ISB's current value approach. As for question one, we believe that the application of current value approach should be restricted to the case in which the receiving entity is a public company. The reason is like this. Comparing with privately held companies, a listed company is expected to have more robust governance and be subject to strict capital market regulation. I think this could imply that even the controlling party might not necessarily have an overwhelming power in deciding on BCUCC transaction. So in this case, the BCUCC transaction might be viewed as having a substance similar to that of ordinary business combinations, which applies current value approach. And also, as for the opt-in and opt-out approach, we do not support the opt-in and opt-out approach for two reasons. Firstly, opt-in and opt-out require the reporting entity to track with non-controlling shareholders whether they prefer opt-in or opt-out of current value approach whenever BCUCC take place. I think this is quite costly. And secondly, accounting policies for BCUCCs may end up being inconsistent between different accounting periods because non-controlling shareholders who are readily able to join or leave the reporting entity may express different preferences in different accounting periods when BCUCC take place. So that's our view. Thank you.
Alberto.
We are not supportive of the opt-in, opt-out approach. We think that it's a bit odd that the choice of the accounting treatment is left to the minority shareholders, non-controlling shareholders. And most above, we see difficult and complex operational issues. How many non-controlling shareholders? Just one? Or should we put a threshold? How much time is given to decide in which form? Just putting the on the website or a register a letter or whatever. I mean, a lot of complex operational issues. So we are not in favor of that. And we believe that even in a situation where the non-controlling shareholders are not in a quoted company, so it's a private company, it should be the same. So we are supportive of adopting IFRS 3, I mean, current value approach for all PCUCC with non-controlling shareholders, irrespective of whether the company is traded in public market or not.
Rieko.
Thank you. I'm going to expand the comments from the AOSSU members. On this topic, BCUCC, we received comments from 8 members. They are Australia, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, and Pakistan. For question 1, if the ISV is to apply a current value approach to transactions which affect NCI of the receiving entity, all members believe it should be applied to both listed and private entities. On the other hand, 3 members believe it should be applied to listed entities only. 4 members believe the approach should be applied to both listed and private entities from conceptual reasons. The status of the entity, whether private or listed, would not be a factor to determine a factor to have a different accounting treatment. Perhaps there is no conceptual rationale to justify different accounting depending on the status of the entity. The information needs of NCI in a listed entity would not be different from the information needs of NCI in a private entity. Those 4 members are divided on whether to support the opt-in or opt-out approach. Some members do not support the opt-in or opt-out approach. They believe such approach is difficult to operationalize. Also, they know the comparability would be affected. Some members support the opt-out approach. They understand cost over current value approach would be more than the benefits of fair value information. So they support the opt-out approach. That's feedback from the 4 members who believe the approach should be applied to both listed and private entities. On the other hand, 3 members believe the approach should be applied to listed entities only from cost perspective. They believe the benefits of fair value information may not always justify the cost for all private entities. The 3 members do not support the opt-in or opt-out approach because it would be difficult to apply in practice and it would be costly. They also believe comparability would be affected depending on the decision by NCI. That's a summary of the comments from AOSSG members on question 1. For question 2, 3 members agree with the staff's analysis and conclusion. That is, they agree that transactions which do not affect the NCI of the receiving entity are different from those which affect NCI. 5 members believe the ISB should also consider other factors in addition to the information needs of NCI. The suggested factors are, for example, how fair value information should be provided without presented or disclosed information needs of prospective equity investors and cost-benefit analysis of each accounting method. That's the summary of the comments from the AOSCC members on question two.
Thank you. Alexandru?
Try to summarize it here. There was not unanimous support for the current value approach, but the overwhelming majority of people support the current value approach for both kinds of entities, thus public and private companies. So this is especially in countries where IFRS is only adopted on a consolidated financial statement, that's maybe not a problem. But in countries that adopt IFRS in the individual financial statement, that becomes a problem because you're going to have the same transaction accounted for in different ways. The unanimous opposition to the opt-in, opt-out, so people get very, very scared about that. So that's going to get accounting treatment because you opt in for that accounting treatment. Or you opt out of that accounting treatment. That's considered weird. One question that so pretty much in the same line as Alberto's comment. So should be used. Overwhelming majority of people support it. Current value approach should be used for both entities. Even people that do not support the current value approach prefer the predecessor approach. Prefer it should be used for both entities. So it should not be a difference between private and listed companies. One question that arose. That situation was the trading in the public market. What does that exactly mean, if you continue for that separation? Because now, trading in a public market is not a homogeneous concept. Some companies can be very liquid, some companies, so obviously GE is traded in a public market, but some companies they have just debentures being traded, some companies have very illiquid equity being traded, some companies had it in the past, had a so it's not a homogeneous concept. So we go to this threshold, it can get very confusing results. So that's pretty much it.
Jim,
let's start with question two: whether there's a difference between transactions with non-controlling and those that don't have non-controlling shareholders. And I think at one end you could say, well, certainly there are some differences. It's not so clear to me that it's quite that binary, because you've even asked the question previously, does there need to be a substantive non-controlling shareholder group? The less substantive that group, the more they look the same. And of course, there's claimants all along the spectrum, not just common equity, but preferred. Sometimes that preferred is classified as debt, so that starts to look more like a non-controlling shareholder group, even though it's classified as debt. And so to me, it's not quite so clear that it's a binary cut. Appreciating that if you're going to make a cut, it needs to have a clear set of rules. And so that might be just a clean spot to draw the line, but it's not economically so clear to me that they're distinct. Similarly, with respect to if you move to a current value basis for those with public shareholders, had similar questions about being very clear what you mean by public market. As markets change over time, even we see that in the U.S., the blurring of the lines between private and public capital with crowdfunding and other things, do you get different answers? And so having a basis that would be very clear in those situations as to why the line is drawn where it is might be difficult. All of which I think leads me more to a single approach, although I would prefer a predecessor approach. I think it's worked in the U.S. by and large to have a predecessor approach, and it isn't necessarily clear that stepping up or a current value approach provides in all cases such sufficiently better information for users to make that analysis than predecessor information on a comparable basis, which of course users are having to do if there isn't a combination. They're using that same information to make predictions of cash flows. And so from a cost-benefit standpoint, it wasn't clear to me that you're necessarily going to meet that threshold, even drawing the lines necessarily where you do. All of which, though, is to say it's probably preferable to have answers to the questions as opposed to what you have, is I get that if you are going to do it, having operable lines is and these seem to be that starting point, although the opt-in and opt-out, I think similar observations about challenges about operationality there.
Sorry. I spent Friday last week at an outreach event in China with various stakeholders on BCUCC, so I thought I'd share the observations I heard, my takeaways from that discussion on these topics in China's absence. So, and the context, I think, for their responses on the specific questions is a continuing view from China that they don't really agree with the use of a current value approach, even for the non-controlling shareholder situation. In part, I think, because they feel the predecessor approach has worked well in China, but also they had some investors at the meeting that we had last week, and they held the view that the continuity of information was more important to them, and so they were preferred a predecessor approach. So I think that's the context for the responses, but just to give a little bit of colour. And before we get into the basis for the different cuts in question one, the first comment that came up was very similar to Jay Ho's comment about the conceptual framework. A couple of the participants there held the view that if you're meant to be looking from the reporting entity's perspective, so why would you be thinking about it differently because of different types of investors, primary users in the entity? So they weren't sure that that was an appropriate application of the conceptual framework. Then getting on to the two different alternatives, they don't really support either of these alternatives, probably because they don't really support a current value approach in part. But on the opt-in, opt-out in particular, they had a few specific concerns. One was about the practicalities of how you'd actually get that feedback to know which decision to make. The other one that they raised was slightly nuanced but along similar lines, was they felt that it was quite a complicated question to ask investors, particularly if you had investors who weren't terribly sophisticated investors, to understand for them what the consequence was of saying, I want predecessor method or current value method. They thought was quite a nuanced question to throw at investors if they weren't professional investors, and they were concerned about what education you would need to go through and how practical it would be to do that, to get an informed sense of feedback. And I thought that was quite an interesting practical observation.
Alexandru.
Yeah, sorry.
Paul.
Thank you. Perhaps a general observation, first of all, which is that as far as the UK is concerned, this hasn't been a major issue, and you know, where such transactions have taken place, there's been a reasonable consensus of how things should be treated. So I don't think it's a big issue for the UK. However, in terms of looking at the specific questions, I think our starting point was that we thought the staff had come up with quite a good balance between the cost of the current value approach and safeguarding minority interest, which I think is quite important, and clearly that's what seeks to be achieved through this. However, listening to the discussion, I start to question, from various comments made, the sort of cost-benefit analysis of companies being able to opt out or opt in, perhaps changes depending on how complicated we make the boundaries of when you can and when you can't. Clearly what the whole proposal is trying to do is to provide some opportunity for companies to avoid incurring unnecessary costs where it's a transaction amongst the group, for the and that clearly doesn't work well where there is non-controlling shareholders in a public market, where I think you shouldn't have exemptions from the normal accounting requirements. I can see where in private there may be circumstances, but I think we need to make sure it is very clear, so the cost of trying to get round what the boundaries would be don't outweigh the benefits of not having to do the current value approach.
I'd like to make one comment maybe before it gets a little bit too late in the discussion. So there were a few comments around the tables around sort of our focus on primary users being not entirely consistent with conceptual framework. So what I would like to clarify, and maybe we haven't managed to find a good articulation of what we're trying to achieve. But essentially, what we're trying to say is that we already have IFRS 3. This is a default position that the acquisition method provides useful information about business combinations. Now the question becomes, in business combinations under common control, are there any circumstances when we walk away from that default position, either because there are not enough interested users, for example, we don't have non-controlling shareholders, because of cost benefits, or maybe because some business combinations under common control are sufficiently different from business combinations that are not under common control. And this is building on the comment that Jim made earlier. I could not agree more that there isn't a binary distinction between business combinations under common control that affect non-controlling shareholders and those that do not. It's not binary. It's sort of a range of possibilities, and on one end of the range, we have a transaction that is very similar to a regular business combination. On the other end of this range, we have a transaction that is very different to a regular business combination. And the question becomes where and how on that continuum we make a distinction. And no distinction would ever be ideal, but the question is how we can best provide it. And what we're trying to achieve by our proposals is essentially a simple idea of, if we have substantive NCI, substantive non-controlling shareholders, we need to give them current value information like we do for any business combination. When we don't have substantive non-controlling shareholders, then for all sorts of reasons, we go for a predecessor approach. And the whole question becomes, well, how do we articulate this substantive idea? And our thoughts was, well, publicly traded entities will probably be substantive enough, maybe some private. So that's the essence of what we are trying to do. And just one last observation. I keep wondering, because again, for us, the starting point is, to the extent business combinations under common control are similar to a regular business combination, same information should be provided. So I wonder whether those stakeholders who object to using current value information for any business combinations under common control, whether they would also prefer a different approach for regular business combinations. So that's a bit that is not entirely
noble.
Yes, thank you. I'm not going to repeat the arguments, but we are very similar to Korea and potentially China that you mentioned about the consistency with the conceptual framework.
Can you speak up a little bit, Noble?
So I'm not going to repeat what I said, but I think we're very similar to Korea and China in our understanding of the conceptual framework and how you are dealing with it. We don't think the substance of a transaction changes just because you have different users. That would be our major concern. Regarding your opt-in and opt-out, I think we agree with the other members who are concerned with the operationality of the proposal, and especially because we are concerned that the users can potentially change, and if they change their minds, those needs might change, and are you really going to change the economy just because you have different users now? So I'm not going to repeat, but I think we're in a similar position to Korea and China.
Sure.
Julia, on this conceptual framework point, can I test something with you? So what I said earlier was repeating what the feedback was that was expressed at the meeting that I was in July last week. But when I was listening to that feedback, I wasn't sure that I necessarily agreed. And the way that I was thinking about it, just to test it on you, is that I think the conceptual framework tells us to think about the reporting entity. But it tells us to think about what information is useful for the primary users of that reporting entity. So does that not mean that if you've got different primary users, so in one case you've just got creditors and lenders, and in another case you've got minority interests or non-controlling shareholders, you may reach a different conclusion because you need to think about a different set of primary users. So you may have two reporting entities with similar transactions, but if their user needs are different because their primary users are different, I would have thought the conceptual framework would say, actually, it's okay to do something different in one case than in the other.
And I would agree with that. I would probably add to this, just to sort of for completeness, that normally in the conceptual framework, you would look for common information needs and you go with that. But then sort of understanding those common information needs also needs to be overlaid with cost-benefit considerations. So even if we were to conclude that, okay, maybe current value information is better as a common need in all cases, when we overlay it with the cost-benefit consideration, we may then decide that the predecessor information should be provided in other cases.
Yes, and on the common information needs, I think our discussion has been that for creditors, they've said they really can both sets of information could be useful to them. So they're, in a sense, somewhat indifferent to the approach. And so if it's we've only got external creditors, then maybe it's more cost-effective and useful for them just to have predecessor method information. But if I change my mix of users, and now I have to think about a different common set of users, non-controlling shareholders and creditors, I then look at them and say, well, now I've got that combination. Actually, maybe current value is better, but then we need to think about cost-benefit. But that would be how I would have applied the conceptual framework.
Yeah? And just to build on what Sue's saying as well, in the recognition and measurement chapter of the conceptual framework, it also talks about what thought process to go through when the board's making recognition and measurement decisions. And there it says that the requirement basically is to look at what's going to be relevant information and faithful representation and cost benefit.
Noble?
Yes, thank you. So I think we said this in earlier meetings, but our concern is that once so there is a difference between the composition of the users, we understand that. But I think the argument that we are hearing is that when you have non-controlling shareholders, you are basically saying that the controlling shareholders is no longer relevant. And I don't think maybe it's a communicate. Well,
they're not a primary user under our conceptual framework.
Yes, so that's my understanding. But then that, as long as you have controlling shareholders, there is a constant need for them to have the predecessor method based information. And but at one point you say because you have non-controlling shareholders, that actually overrides the needs of the controlling shareholders. And I think that's where we don't agree.
But I guess if we were to apply conceptual framework, it focuses on information needs, and controlling shareholder, unlike non-controlling shareholders, does not need to rely on external financial statements to meet the information needs.
But then if that's the case, you don't need to care about controlling shareholders at any point of time, not just for these BCUCCs, and I think we don't see a consistency there. And we believe that even though they might have, because based on the definition of control, they do have the other means of getting the information, we still think that the controlling shareholders are part of the primary users. So I think that's where we're having differences of views.
Andrew?
Thank you. At a high level, not reiterating what everybody's kind of said already, from the current value approach, the information needs may not necessarily be that different between those users of a public company and a private company. So we wouldn't necessarily draw that distinction in terms of whether or not that's not the line we would use to draw. We might look at a different metric. We might look at whether or not the non-controlling interest is held by a related party. So that might be something that we could consider or look at it more from a principle-based perspective. And when I say whether or not it's held by a related party, if it's held by a related party, the economics are different. In that case, you're not necessarily at market terms when you're transacting with a related party versus not transacting with a related party. So a current value approach, you'd be relying on the fair value that's generated through the business combination accounting to validate that. So I'm concerned with that. But you might look at other factors like whether or not the percentage ownership and then a non-controlling interest is substantive. You know, is it significant versus the mere existence of non-controlling interest? How substantively the percentage change in the non-controlling interest before and after the transaction, and whether or not the non-controlling interest is public or not. So while we wouldn't necessarily draw the distinction on a clean line, we would look at the balance of evidence potentially there to assess whether or not what the best information needs are for the users of the financial statements. To the second question on the opt-in and opt-out, I think we would reiterate what others are saying, operational challenges there in terms of what that might look like, and it could be challenging to implement, both for public companies and private companies.
Cédric.
Thank you. Well, France, we are in a specific context, but I would say that first, in our jurisdiction, we assume that the transactions are done at fair value, at arm's length. There is no specific risk of having transaction price that would not be at arm's length, mm-hmm. and because of the regulation. And the second point is that we also have we take the point of view of the parent company, which is a listed company and prepared IFRS financial statement. In that context, the NCS. The existence of non-controlling shareholders at the level of the receiving entity is relevant information because it's a kind of external party to an internal transaction within the IFRS financial statement of the parent company. So it's probably the most relevant divider that we would consider. Compared with the second one that you suggest here, between public and publicly traded or privately held receiving entity, so that actually, if we remove the second criterion, the question of opt-in, opt-out is not necessary to consider, and I think it's probably. Practical solution to the question of opt-in, opt-out, which may be or entail some practical difficulties to apply.
So may I just clarify to be absolutely sure about your view? So I hear that you don't support opt-in, opt-out, as many people already express this view. But are you saying that you would then support a current value approach only for listed companies, or would you support a current value approach if non-controlling shareholders are present, regardless of whether the entity is listed or not?
The second solution,
okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
I would only consider the existence of NCS okay. if between these two criteria that you suggest. Okay.
Raymond.
Thank you. We just got three issues I think we are concerned about. The first is consistency of application between the different types of entities. So whether I'm listed, unlisted, or I'm in the process of listing, the accounting shouldn't be any different between the different types of entities. But what I'm seeing here is something that would make a differentiation between those different types of entities. And if I'm looking to list at some point in the future, again, to try and meet the whole concept of is information relevant and reliable and all of that, that would to indicate to me that the current value approach would be the appropriate way of dealing with the accounting. So effectively, I think the issue then becomes one of consistency between the different types of entities, rather than trying to make a differentiation between the different types of entities that you might potentially come across. The second issue will be around operational matters, around the various options. How would you actually apply this in practice? And we fail to understand how that would work in reality, and I think that must be considered in a little bit more detail. The third issue is around on question two on slide 20, on transactions that don't affect non-controlling shareholders. We agree with where the staff are going with the staff's observations, is that predecessor accounting has worked to some extent. So to the extent that it has worked, we'll continue to apply that. So the approach that has been taken, we agree.
Again, may I just clarify to make sure I'm taking correct takeaways? So you are saying on question two that you agree with other observations and you agree with a predecessor approach for transactions where there are no non-controlling shareholders. So are you saying that if there are non-controlling shareholders, you wouldn't make a distinction based on whether it's listed or non-listed? You wouldn't apply opt-in, opt-out? And are you generally supportive of current value approach if there are non-controlling shareholders?
So if the non-controlling shareholders are saying we're supportive of applying a predecessor type accounting to it, so effectively
there are non-controlling shareholders.
There are no non-controlling shareholders.
Okay. I think he said if there are no non-controlling.
Okay. Yeah. And if there are,
Now, if they are, then we're going back to so I'm going on going back to question number one, where in question number one you proposing the current value approach. I'm saying, well, with the current value approach, happy with the current value approach, but I wouldn't make a distinction then between a listed company, non-listed company, or a company soon to be listed. Because I think what this is suggesting to me is that if it's a listed company, then current value approach is the way to go. If it's a non-listed company, then, well, you can go and do something else. You can opt out of applying the current value accounting. And I'm saying, well, there should be consistency between the two the minute you've got non-controlling shareholders involved in any situation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alberto.
I want to reiterate.
Could you put your screen down? Your webcast, we can't hear you because your screen's. We won't be able to hear you on the webcast. There you go.
Okay.
Need to hear. Reveal the mic.
Okay. I want to reiterate the view, my view, our view, that non-controlling interests are very important stakeholders. This is also expressed by the fact that in many jurisdictions, when there are this business combination under common control, there are legal provisions which are aimed to protect the non-controlling interest. They do not deal with the accounting treatment. They deal with the fairness of the price in order not to squeeze out, let's say, the minority shareholders. But nonetheless, it's a demonstration that non-controlling interests are always important, and irrespective whether the receiving entity is quoted or simply a private company.
Jim.
I wanted to respond, Julia, to your question about, one, whether those that prefer predecessor would have a same view with respect to non-BC-UCC transactions, and then two, maybe how you articulated it in terms of you're trying to find those that look very much like business combinations under IFRS 3 versus just rearranging stuff within a controlled set of companies, and maybe if that were the basis, and then the secondary factor might be that different types of shareholders might benefit differentially. But if the basis were we're trying to distinguish between two things, and this is why we're drawing the line, by the way, it has a benefit to shareholders, that might be easier. People could agree or disagree with the cut, but at least you could say this is what we're trying to do. And I think you do that, but maybe more of a focus on that. And then to your question, I do have a different view when it's outside of a control group. And of course, the accounting is different all along the way, including at the parent organization. At the parent level, whose shareholders are also using that information to make resource allocation decisions, when it's outside of common control, of course, you have step up with respect to the transaction at all levels, including at the parent level if there's a business combination. Here, we're talking about stepping it up, but only at one level. So at the parent level, you're still going to have predecessor information, I believe, and shareholders are going to be making resource allocation decisions just as important at that level as they are at the lower level. And, of course, shareholders may be doing analysis on a segment or other basis that will have predecessor information. So if you conclude that predecessor is good when you're making resource allocation or acceptable when you're making resource allocation decisions at the higher level, to me it's a much bigger hurdle than to conclude that the accounting should be different at the lower level. It doesn't. That's where I start to question the cost benefit, and
so
maybe the financial reporting looks different to me when you're making that decision in a common control group.
The difference that I think the staff are focusing on is that at the ultimate level, you always had control over everything, and you've still got control over everything, so nothing much has changed. Whereas if I'm looking at the receiving entities level and I'm a non-controlling shareholder, I've now got access to the risks and benefits of something that I didn't have access to before.
So I understand that piece, but to me it doesn't mean that if shareholders at the parent are able to make resource allocation decisions using historical financial information, it would seem that resource providers at the lower level would be able to use that same information to make resource allocation decisions. I get that there's been a change in NCI, but the information still seems useful for making resource allocation decisions. If it wasn't, it shouldn't be used at the parent.
I think what is quite important here is that when you look at the ultimate parent level, from their point of view, nothing has changed. The thing move internally, but they have exactly the same residual interest in the underlying assets before and after the transaction. If I go below the ultimate controlling party level, and by the way, we haven't really gotten into this level of detail on the slides, but within a group structure, you can have more than one receiving entity. If it is a complex structure, a transaction can actually have an effect at different levels apart from the top parent level. And so when you have non-controlling shareholders at other levels in the group and they are affected by that acquisition, for them something has changed, they now acquired residual equity claim in the underlying assets which they didn't have
before. I don't dispute that at all. Something has changed. To me, it doesn't mean that change then forces current value accounting as being somehow more useful to them but not useful at the higher level. Something's changed. It just doesn't mean to me that automatically means you need fair value or step-up accounting.
Chiara, sorry to keep you waiting so long.
Well, there was general support for the approach under which listed entities should apply the current value approach. And for privately received entities, members saw that the predecessor approach should be the starting point. But it was also observed that there are other transactions different from the transaction where the receiving entity is listed, for which the current value makes sense, such as when the owners of listed bonds would be interested in the current value information. Coming back to the predecessor method for as a starting point for privately receiving entities, members think that this method would be the least cost method, and therefore it seemed the logical starting point to start with. And if we had to choose between the opt-in and the opt-in was seen as more practical than the opt-out. But for sure there was no support for using quantitative thresholds of percentage of NCA in the receiving entity as a differentiating factor, because it was perceived to be rule-based. There was also support that the predecessor method could be used when the non-controlling shareholders and the receiving entities are related parties. Then coming to the question two, we have heard different views. From one end, it seems that the ISB staff has collected sufficient evidence for the approach proposed. But again, it was observed that lenders would not agree to receive different information depending on whether the receiving entity was at non-controlling shareholders or not. So it was noted that lenders were interested in assessing future cash flows, but they were also understanding in knowing the fair value of the transactions and of the considerations. It was also noted that the debt instruments could be convertible, and so the lender could be a potential non-stakeholder, non-controlling stakeholder in the future also.
I think that there's an underlying assumption, now that's discussed, that the informational needs of controlling shareholders and non-controlling shareholders are completely different. And in practice, controlling shareholders materialize their influence in a company to board members they elect. They are not managing the company, so they need the same financials to understand what's going on in the company. Of course, there are controlling shareholders that are managing the company on a day-to-day basis, but that's not always the case, especially when institutional investors are involved, or families that are not running the company anymore. So the presence of the non-controlling shareholder here, I think, fulfills two functions. One is this distinction about informational needs that, well, I'm not very sure is that different. The other one is just to be sure that this transaction exists in reality. What I mean is this Because when I have a controlling shareholder, that they have two companies and one company buys the other, that can be motivated, that can be an artificial transaction. What I mean by that, it can be just for tax reasons, for example. So there is no economic substance behind the transaction. Normally, when you have a non-controlling shareholder, the controlling shareholder, they agree on price. Sometimes, in some countries, for example, controlling shareholders cannot even vote in those transactions. So only the non-controlling shareholders can vote on the transaction. So and then the presence of non-controlling shareholders can be a proxy for an actual transaction with economic substance. So in my view, the presence of non-controlling shareholders is much more in that direction than on actually the demand for different kind of information, really. Is I think this is a weakest, sorry, a stronger assumption than it is, needs to be the case.
Okay. Maybe it would be useful if I attempt to summarize.
Yes.
So overall, obviously, we have heard diverse views. I think it's fair to say that there isn't much support for opt-in or opt-out. I think it's also fair to say that overall, apart from three members, if my counting is right, I think overall there is support for using current value information for transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders, either based on substance argument or based on affirmation needs argument or cost benefit or sort of a combination of all of them, but there is support. There was a suggestion about instead of trying to draw a binary distinction, for example, one that considers just listed, non-listed, to consider a combination of factors like the size of NCI, the nature of NCI, other related parties, how much they changed as a result of the transaction. So I think we will need to go away and think about a little bit more about how we articulate this idea of substantive NCI, but it seems there is sort of support for this direction overall.
Okay. Now we would like to focus on how each approach would apply. However, in discussing how each approach would apply, please keep in mind when that approach would apply, as illustrated on slide 13. Slide 22-26 cover how any distribution or a contribution could be reflected in financial statements when applying a current value approach for a BCUCC. I'd like to highlight two important points. First of all, providing information about a contribution or a distribution does not modify IFRS 3. This is because IFRS 3 already requires an entity to separately account for any part of the consideration transferred that is not part of the acquired business. Secondly, we don't expect such transactions to be common in practice. Sorry, such scenarios to be common in practice. We understand that in some jurisdictions there could be regulations in place that require transactions that affect non-controlling shareholders to be conducted at fair value. However, that may not always be the case. We have reached out to various stakeholders, including ASAF members, to better understand when any such regulations are present. As illustrated on slide 24, if the price paid in a BCUCC exceeds the fair value of the acquired business and expected synergies, that difference economically represents a distribution by the receiving entity to its parent. As illustrated on slide 25, we identified two alternatives for providing information about any such distribution in the financial statements, either by recognition or by disclosure. Recognition would arguably best reflect the economics of the transaction, but it would also require measurement, and measurement of a distribution would be subject to measurement uncertainty. On the contrary, we think that providing information about any contribution is less challenging, as we can use the existing mechanics in IFRS 3 for recognizing a gain. As is illustrated on slide 26, if the price paid is lower than the fair value of the acquired assets and liabilities, that difference economically represents a contribution by the parent to the receiving entity rather than a gain. How to account for a distribution or a contribution when applying a current value approach has been also discussed at the last joint CMAC and GPF meeting. The majority of CMAC and GPF members shared the view that measuring any distribution would be highly subjective and uncertain. However, the majority of CMAC and GPF members expressed the preference for recognizing a distribution. Nonetheless, many CMAC and GPF members also stated that there will be a regulatory or contractor protection in place and suggested that such distribution are not common in practice. Questions related to how a current value approach should apply are included on slide 27. Question number 3 relates to regulation of a transaction price and focuses on whether there are legal requirements in your jurisdictions related to the transaction price in a BCCC, and if so, what they are and which transactions they apply to. We already received information on that question from some jurisdictions. However, we welcome any additional information at this meeting. Question number 4 relates to information about the distribution. Which alternative identified on slide 25 for providing information about the distribution in a BCCC do you prefer and why? Question number 5 relates to information about the contribution. Do you agree that in a BCCC, any excess of fair value of the acquired assets and liabilities over consideration transferred should be recognized as a contribution to the receiving entity's equity? Reference to slide 26. And yeah, with that, we open the floor for the discussion.
Oh,
yes, thank you. On the regulations, in our jurisdictions, we do not have any legal requirements about the transaction price. However, we do have tax laws that do affect the transactions. There are tax consequences when the transaction price is not on market terms, and therefore that kind of drives the behavior of the companies actually doing the BCUCCs. The tax rules do not distinguish between normal business combinations and BCUCCs, so it's a general concept, but that's in place. That does drive the behavior. In terms of the distribution and contribution, our understanding is that one of the basic assumptions underlying the current accounting is that the transactions are an exchange of equals. So we don't recognize day one gains or losses only under exceptional circumstances. And I think that's why we use the transaction price to account for related party transactions, acknowledging that transactions may not be at an arm's length terms, but we do disclose the fact that it is a transaction with related party. And so trying to recognize this difference in a BCUCC as a distribution or contribution seems to be inconsistent with the general idea that everything is accounted for under an exchange of equals. And I think it's very difficult to justify that departure from that general concept. If the ISB were to somehow account for this difference, we question why this goes directly as an equity transaction, not consider whether to recognize any gains or losses on the transaction. Well, we understand that the difference could eventually increase or decrease the value to existing shareholders. We think there needs to be consideration as to whether it should go through the income statement or not.
Rieko.
Also, AOSS2 for question 4 and question 5. 3 member support recognizing the overpayment or underpayment as distribution or contribution in equity. Such treatment would represent the substance of the transaction. They also support measuring the distribution and the excess of the consideration over the fair value of the acquired business. On the other hand, 3 members are concerned about practical difficulties for the suggested approaches. In particular, they are concerned about recognizing the distribution component in the equity because it is difficult to reliably measure the fair value of the business acquired to determine the amount of distribution. Also, non-controlling shareholders may challenge the legality of the transactions. They may challenge whether the transactions are legal ones. That may happen, especially where there is regulation to protect the interest of non-controlling shareholders. These 3 members believe IFR 3 plus additional disclosures could be a pragmatic way to deal with BCUCC. Such an approach would be understandable and less complex than the suggested approaches. That approach would also provide information which is comparable with business combinations with third parties. Additional disclosures would include purpose of transactions and how the consideration is determined. In addition, one member is concerned about the risk that the overpayment is included in goodwill if the entities do not properly perform impairment testing under IAS 36. That's comments from AOSSC members for question 4 and question 5.
Chiara.
Well, several jurisdictions, as already also observed by Alberto, require that the prices do not unfairly treat the shareholders without necessarily prescribing a valuation method. And in some jurisdictions, it's required that transactions are at fair value for tax purposes, for example. On question 4 and question 5, there was support for the idea that if the receiving entity paid too much or too little, then there was a distribution or a contribution that should be accounted for as such. However, there were no views yet whether the assessment should be based on what a market participant would pay or on how much the business was worth for the receiving party. In addition, it was noted that a requirement to always calculate the fair value of the acquired assets would be very costly. For example, sometimes the exchange is realized through exchange of shares. In this case, it's not necessary to calculate the fair value in terms of absolute value, because it's enough to have the relative value exchanged. And then as a practical way forward, it was suggested to consider whether there could be a rebuttable presumption, at least in the jurisdictions where the fairness of the price is required. So a rebuttable presumption that the receiving entity did not pay too much or too little.
Alberto.
On question 3, I have nothing to add to what Chiara said, because it applies to many European jurisdictions, including ours. On 4 and 5, well, we believe that, maybe we are isolated on this, but we believe that if current value information is valid, then why bother about distribution, contribution, and trying to figure out the amount of this distribution, especially this distribution, and so on. We believe we should just apply IFRS 3 to business combination under common control equally on any other business combination with not under common control. It's very, very simple. It's also very simple from a standard setting point of view. It's just removing the exception.
Jeho.
As for question 3, we already sent our response to the ISP staff in April. And as for question 4 and 5, we agree with measuring the underpayment as contribution in equity, as it appropriately depicts the substance of the transaction, which is a transaction with owners in their capacity as owners. We also agree in theoretical terms that overpayment should be identified as distribution on the same ground. However, we are skeptical about its viability because of the measurement difficulty. So we support the disclosure approach in which distribution is subsumed within goodwill rather than separately identifying it. For the first recognition approach, in which a distribution is measured as the excess of the consideration of the fair value of the acquired business, we are concerned about undue cost burdens entailed by the process of measuring the fair value of the acquired business, which is not required for ordinary business combinations at all. We also consider that testing goodwill for impairment immediately and identifying the impairment loss as a distribution could cause a measurement problem, in particular because inconsistent measurement basis may end up being compared. At the end of the day, the fair value of consideration paid may be compared with the value in use of the acquired business if the value in use exceeds net fair value of the asset. Then is the difference, which is purported to be a distribution, at fair value or in value in use? So I'm not sure about the measurement basis. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of question three, regulations around transaction price, there are various legal requirements on directors if they sell assets at undervalue, and they particularly come into force if at some point in the future the business becomes insolvent. I suspect it's unlikely to occur in these circumstances, but one needs to be aware of that. There are also capital market requirements around transactions with related parties where the thresholds for shareholder approval is and actually having somebody value the transaction to make sure that the non-controlling shareholders are not disadvantaged. And then there are also legal requirements around the selling company. If they distribute or sell the assets at undervalue, then they need to have distributable reserves to do so. So it's quite a mixture of complicated regulations around that. In terms of the examples on slide 25, I think we start on the basis that perhaps the most pragmatic answer is that this should be a rebuttable presumption. So I think it's the point that Chirara was making, that the transaction was at fair value. But we prefer, in terms of the two examples here, we prefer the recognition basis rather than the disclosure basis.
Jim.
So on question three, perhaps similar to what Paul described in terms of legal or regulatory requirements, probably go beyond that into contractual requirements, which might not just exist for non-controlling shareholders, but other claimants, which might be debt agreements or other things, which could govern the ability to transfer assets back and forth, which I suspect is not uncommon. On questions four and five, if the idea is to identify those that look more like business combinations, this seems to take a step backwards and say, well, these might not actually look like arm's-length business combinations because we can't separate the fact that there are controlling parties involved, and so there may be other things going on. It seems if you have the line set properly in terms of those that look like business combinations get accounted for as business combinations, perhaps the presumption could be that those that are in that bucket shouldn't get specialized accounting. If there happens to be a gain on sale, treat it like you would under IFRS 3. And I'm not sure that users would necessarily have any disadvantage or advantage whether that gain, that purchase gain was recorded to equity or recorded in the income statement. I'm not sure they're going to use that information differentially. But here it says you'd get differential accounting. I'd talk to users because I suspect in either case they're going to ignore that gain in terms of their go-forward analysis. And I'm not sure that identifying any overpayment would be any easier here than in any other business combination transaction in which an overpayment could occur. So I'm not sure once you get the scope right, you need specialized accounting for trying to identify those two things.
Alexander.
Question three here in the same line as Paul and Jim. There are many, several regulations requiring. Actually, there are regulations requiring an external appraisal of fair value, a fairness opinion given by a third party for the transaction to be concluded in Brazil. So, but having said that, and listen to my colleagues here, I come to slide 24, and the first bullet here, the business combination of the common control may be directed by the controlling party in the undertaking to produce benefits for other entities within. I would like just to, I think in the same line as Jean mentioned now, is this really the good representation of what happened in reality? Because if that happens, maybe we should question if that's a business combination or not. I'm going a little bit on the Alberto's point, which is If someone is doing this combination to distribute money around along the entities that this individual, this person, this group already controls, probably there's no economic substance in that. This is not a business combination that can control. This is not a business combination in the first place. This is something motivated for a tax reason, rearranging for a tax purposes, for example, to generate goodwill, to get amortization of goodwill in countries where goodwill is it's tax deductible. So I think if you go back to IFRS 3, I think we already have answers for this. It's not different to because distribution from equity, identify the distribution from equity here, assuming that the transactions are not fair price, it is really something that I'm finding hard to see it. I mean, how could that happen? So say, well, the fair value evaluation is 10 million, and now this board decides to pay 15 million because this board wants to pay more than it is a fair value. You know what I mean? It's probably something else happening. It's not a transaction between independent parties. So I don't know if that situation is a real situation. I mean, I don't know how the inspiration for this is. That's my view here. Question. I don't know if you saw that happening or I don't know the inspiration for this. I just find it very hard to happen. So imagine you're on a board approving this. You have a fair value assessment here and they're paying completely different price. Or if you're selling below price, it's having a fair value assessment. It's probably against the law in many countries, at least I my view. May be wrong. But.
Julia?
It's quite a tricky question, and it's, you know, it's excellent observations. That's exactly what we are thinking about. Maybe a couple of comments here, and also to what Jim said earlier, as to whether, if you have sort of this overpayment or underpayment component, whether it's very different from a regular business combination. So first of all, I just like to reiterate that in IFRS 3, we already have the concept that if part of the consideration transferred is for something other than acquired business, you would be required to account for this part of consideration transferred in accordance with applicable standards. So, for example, you can make a payment, and part of that is in exchange for control over the acquired business, and part of that relates to future employee services. So then you would separate consideration into two components and would account for them separately. So we are sort of dealing with a similar concept here. We have a transaction where I do have a business combination under common control. Why? Because my receiving entity acquired control over the acquired business, and there are non-controlling shareholders and that receiving entities that are affected. So in that sense, there is a business combination under common control, but then part of the payment is something else. Part of the payment is actually a distribution to the controlling party. The question does become
that distribution for the controlling party that I'm finding very hard to see that being legally done. You know what I mean?
And I completely agree with you, which is why we're saying on slide 24 that we think it's probably not common in practice, but as of today we haven't really collected enough evidence to say that indeed is the case and that it cannot happen. And the question arises, well, if it does happen, even if it's rare, should we provide some sort of accounting for that? And maybe it is starting with a rebuttable presumption, but then still, if the presumption is not met, what happens?
You may question those fair value opinions, those fairness opinions that say they are rubbish, but that's another discussion. That applies to IFRS 3 as a whole. I think it's another.
Mm. Cedric?
Similar to what has been said previously, I confirm what Chiara said, that there is in France actually legal requirement to make such transaction at arm's length. And in addition, there is no differentiation done between BCUCC and other transactions, and no evaluation methodology is provided. And it's very often the predecessor method that will apply in France for internal situation like BCUCC. Having said that, I think question 4 automatically lapsed, actually. But question 5, I was not sure to get completely the point, since in slide 24, you consider the question of having a distribution, does it mean that if I had a bad will in the transaction, would you require to record it as a distribution rather than as a gain in any way? Or is it only for the excess to the normal price? Or does it also embed the situation where you may have a bad will in a transaction?
We are looking at both. So slides 24 and 25 are about what if you paid too much, and then the question is, well, how do I sort of separate this component? And slide 26 deals with what happens if you paid too little. So we do look at both scenarios.
No, I mean, in a situation where you pay too little, or where you will recognize less fair value of the assets than the price you paid. So you have actually a bad will. And let's assume that it's a fair price anyway. So you are in the legal context where you have to pay the fair price, but you can't recognize more than you have, so that you have such a difference, which is actually a bad will. You get more assets you recognize more assets than the cash you receive, for example. You have a bad will. Would you recognize that bad will as a distribution in equity anyway, or would it be possible to recognize it as a gain, like under IFRS 3?
It's a contribution. In case of bad will, you have a contribution to equity, so yes, it doesn't go to profit and loss.
Sorry, contribution. But would it be then a contribution in equity, or can it be still a gain?
The suggestion is a contribution to equity.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you would depart then from IFRS 3 in that regard?
Yes.
Okay.
That contribution to equity increases my ownership, my participation.
Being treated as if it were a contribution to equity, not in legal form, but sort of in substance, if you like.
Like OCI is something.
Equity, not
OCI.
And it's sort of not, I think the way staff are thinking about it, it's not necessarily departure from IFRS 3, but as rather it's sort of consideration of requirements in IS 1 and IFRS 3 sort of together. So if the substance of the transaction is that it's a transaction with owners acting in their capacity as such, then it is a contribution to equity.
I just mean that if you increase your equity participation, you're going to have, by the equity method, you're going to recognize it. I have 10% of a company investing 10 million. Now I have 12 million invested.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
So it comes through P&L anyway.
Direct to equity.
Yeah,
not through
P&L. An investor company.
Not so, through P&L.
No. So it's in the accounting.
It doesn't go to P&L. You simply recognize the movement in the participation.
But increase your participation from 10% to 12% in my example. For example,
not changing the percentage, just saying it's got a different value.
It's more paid in capital.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Weird, isn't it?
Andrew.
Thank you. In terms of question three, we sent our responses to the staff in April, but largely consistent with what Jim said in Canada as well. Geography-wise, in terms of what it looks like contribution to income, and I think as long as it's clear in terms of what's going on, a user can figure it out and they'll do with it what they want to do with it. When we looked at the recognition versus disclosure-only approach, we had some questions in terms of the mechanics of the disclosure-only approach. So if we look at the disclosure-only approach, it assumes that the difference is subsumed into existing goodwill. And then subsequently tested for impairment. So we started thinking about, what if there is an existing goodwill? What happens then? What if we have a bargain purchase? How would that difference be subsumed? Would it be recognized as an impairment? We were just trying to figure out what the mechanics of that would look like in different scenarios. So while we understand kind of where it's headed, maybe just a little bit of refinement in terms of what some of those different things might look like in those types of situations might be helpful.
Okay. Let's move to the final.
Yeah, the final topic. The next topic focuses on providing pre-combination information, including comparative information about combined businesses when applying a predecessor approach. We identified two alternatives for providing pre-combination information described on slide 30. Under alternative A, entities are combined from the beginning of the comparative period, and recombination information is provided for all combined entities. For example, assuming a calendar year end, if a BCUCC takes place on the 1st of June 2019, the combining entities will be combined from the 1st of January 2018. Under alternative B, entities are combined from the date of the transaction, similar to the acquisition method, and precombination information is provided only for the receiving entity. Using my previous example, if a BCUCC takes place on the 1st of June 2019, the entities will be combined from the 1st of June 2019. Information for 2018 and for the first 6 months of 2019 will be for the receiving entity only. To illustrate these alternatives, we provided illustrative scenarios on slide 32 to 36. All those scenarios consider transactions that do not affect non-controlling shareholders. In some cases, transactions between wholly owned entities will represent a continuation of a previous reporting entity in a new legal form, as presented on slides 32 and 34. In those cases, both alternatives would result in the same outcome, and precombination information will be that of the previous reporting entity, and it will generally be available. However, in other cases, the transaction will not be a continuation of a previous reporting entity in a new legal form. Instead, the transaction would result in a new set of assets, liabilities, and operations being reported together for the first time, as presented on slides 33, 35, and 36. In those cases, providing precombination information for all combining entities could be difficult and could involve judgments and estimates. That is particularly true for the scenario 1B on slide 33 that would involve providing carve-out historical information. Also, this topic has been discussed at the last CIMAC and GPF joint meeting. The majority of CIMAC and GPF members generally considered precombination information for all combining entities useful for users of the financial statements. However, the majority of CIMAC members expressed their preference for a prospective accounting in primary financial statements and providing precombination information for all combining entities in the notes of the financial statements. GPF members generally considered it feasible to provide precombination information if they were separate legal entities. However, they stated that providing precombination information would be more difficult and judgmental where no separate legal entities existed before the combination, their carve-out scenario. The last question of today's session is included in slide 38, and which alternative identified on slide 36 of Agenda Paper 1A for providing precombination information do you prefer and why?
Yara?
Well, it was noted that users find comparative figures extremely useful, but the attention was focusing on the carve-out. In particular, there were problems in restating comparative figures when the predecessor method was not previously, when the business did not previously prepare separate accounts. In particular, in this circumstance, the information, the comparative, was considered not to be reliable and therefore not usable. In this case, maybe members would have preferred the pro forma figures, but outside the financial statements.
Outside, meaning in the notes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. How from AOSSG? Four members support alternative A, while one member supports alternative B. Four members support alternative A because providing pre-combination information for all combining entities would help investors to perform the trend analysis of the combining entities. Among the four members, one member noted for transactions which do not affect NCI, there is no acquisition at the level of the shareholders of the receiving entity. So pre-combination information should be provided for all combining entities. Another member note, under alternative B, pre-combination information is provided based on the identity of the receiving entity. Such alternative B would not be an effective way to provide useful information to users. On the other hand, one member supports alternative B because there will be practical difficulties in alternative A. There will be difficulties, for example, when the acquired business did not prepare separate financial statements before the combination, or when the combining entities have different accounting policies. For the approaches suggested in the paper, two members would like to know more about the two factors on slide 31 of agenda paper. The two factors are continuation of a previous reporting entity and a new set of net assets put together. They would like to know conceptual rationale for these two factors. Also, those two members say it's not clear who is the receiving entity in scenario 2B and 2C. In addition, one member suggests more conceptual arguments should be considered. From the controlling party's perspective, it controls all combining entities, both before and after the transaction. Therefore, pre-combination information is provided for all combining entities. On the other hand, from the reporting entity's perspective, it controls the transferred business only from the date of the transaction. So it would not provide pre-combination information of the transferred business. That's just a summary of the comments from AOSSG members.
Paul.
Thank you. I prefer alternative B because I think that better reflects the legal substance of what has actually occurred. Absolutely understand the benefits of appropriate trend analysis, but I think there are other mechanisms for getting that trend analysis, either through the management commentary or through the notes. I can see some challenges if in the comparative period that the business that's been transferred didn't provide audited financial information. I can see the difficulty then of getting that audited and therefore included in the notes to the accounts, and therefore probably on balance think it would be easier to provide it through the management commentary. And that happens quite regularly in combinations in any event in the UK when trying to provide information of what the business would have looked like had an acquisition taken place earlier. And that's not when it's under common control, that's when it's externally. So I think there is some precedence around that. But obviously you have to look at all the APM guidance as well around that.
Any other comments? No? Any concluding comments from you, Juliana? Not sure if it's necessary.
Maybe the concluding comment is that we will walk away and keep thinking, and I'm sure this is not the last time we're talking to you about business combinations under common control. Thank you very much for your input. Thank you.
Let's take a break until 11:15.